Okay, we're rolling. So, the Fabulous 50s, appropriately labeled. One of my favorite moments in U.S. history. So, keep in mind now that we've already been in the 50s. Foreign affairs in the 50s, because that's the start of the Cold War. And there's some reminders about that in here as we go. So, economic woes following World War II, well, surprise, surprise, right? So remember that we're keeping these two lists about war, all the things that are bad about war, and I don't know, we're up into the 800s someplace, and all the things that are good about war. And we've already covered that entire list. It's a list of one. There's one good thing about major war, and that is that it stimulates the economy for obvious reasons. Well, then there's the backside of that. Almost always following major war anyway, there's a backslide on the economy. So the economy takes a bit of a hit. And, well, that's why I say surprise, surprise. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act, better known as the GI Bill, was an important piece of legislation to address the economic woes following World War II. And there's a nice description of that for you. The first president of the 50s is Harry S. Truman. Actually comes to the presidency before the 50s, you know, comes to the presidency first upon the death of FDR. Remember that FDR dies suddenly in his fourth term. And so Truman is going to serve almost the entire fourth term of Roosevelt. And he's going to be responsible for ending World War II. We've visited that once or twice, the half of World War II that is in East Asia. And then he's going to be surprisingly elected to a term of his own. So he is going to serve pretty much two terms, but, you know, he's still a one-term president because he was elected to one term. Considered one of America's top 10 presidents, of course, depending on the list you see. So if you find a list where Truman comes in at 12th, you know, okay, that could be. Strong in, you can guess this, and maybe I've mentioned this before, strong in leadership qualities, crisis management, and character. So I told you, remember, that Truman had the most agonizing decision, my opinion, of any president, before or after, and that's his, you know, how to use this powerful new weapon to end the war and save American lives. A person of lesser leadership ability and crisis management might not have been able to make that decision. So I think in that case, the right man for the moment, I mean the moment of making that decision, whether you agree with the decision or not, the right man for that sort of moment. There was a lot of, I think, in Truman, a lot of Andrew Jackson. But I have a much higher regard for Truman than I do for Jackson, but still, there was that dynamic quality and decisiveness about him. Unlike, let's see, 1850s, Pierce and Buchanan, for example. I love that quote about Truman right at the bottom. Who knows where I came across that. Sometimes small in the small things, but often big in the big things. Sort of a perplexing evaluation. And when I read that, I think back to a previous president, that's pretty much how Benjamin Franklin described John Adams as well. And then the phrase that we associate with Truman is the buck stops here. And he had that on his desk. The buck stops here. So there can be plenty of indecisiveness along the way, plenty of discussion along the way. But here I am. I'm not afraid to make decisions. The buck stops here. In 1848, there was a presidential election of mention. It doesn't quite make the Alice Cooper list, but it's an honorable mention, enough that we need to spend a moment with it here. So think of the presidential statues downtown. Those are kind of cool, really. Some of them are pretty pedestrian, pretty vanilla, but a number of them have an important, really important moment in history. And if you know about the Truman statue, well, he's holding up, he's got a huge grin on his face, he's holding up a newspaper. Well, that newspaper is headlines that Dewey, 1948 election, Dewey defeats Truman. And he's holding that up. And so when America went to bed in November of 1948, the thinking was Thomas Dewey is our next president. But then through the night, the votes were tallied, and turns out Truman defeated Dewey. And so he's holding up the headlines had already been printed in major newspapers. And that's what that's all about. You should also be aware that in that 1848 election, there was a notable third party. And Strom Thurmond from South Carolina was that party's presidential candidate. So at this time now, unlike today, the Democratic Party is still in control of the South. Strom Thurmond did not get the Democratic Party's nomination. I mean, that's Truman. So he'll run as a third party candidate. And much like, Roosevelt branched off from the Republican Party in the 1912 election. And that party is known as the Dixiecrats. So Dixie, South, and then Crats, well, Democrats. So, and both of the terms start with a D, so there you go. Just a very nice merge of those two terms. The Dixiecrats. Segregation and racism are alive and well in the South at this time. And so Strom Thurmond is associated for much of his political career with those two elements, segregation and racism. Long-term senator from South Carolina. All right. And then on to page 2. So there we go. The Cold War dominates foreign affairs. For 45 years, the Cold War dominates foreign affairs. Remember that no key decision was made in terms of foreign affairs by the U.S. Senate or the U.S. government in general that did not have to sort of pass the litmus test of how is the Soviet Union going to react to this. That was an additional element in foreign affairs for 45 years. All right, and so I've listed the important items there under the Truman administration, and if you look through those, most of those should seem very familiar. From lecture, one or two I didn't spend any time with in lecture, but they're in Garrity, in Brinkley, they were on your worksheets, and so forth. So there's a nice little chronological account for you. Halfway down back to domestic issues. So the Fair Deal will extend FDR's New Deal. And you can see limited success. I listed six attempts there and used the emojis to indicate relative success or relative failure. And you can see, well, 4 and 2. So, that's why we would label it limited success. Notice the last one, the first item of the last one, national health insurance. So I think you're probably aware of this, but we associate that, the president we associate that with the most, of course, is Obamacare. But don't think for one minute that was new with Obama and the Democrats. It goes, well, here we go. It goes back a ways. It's just that no president, Democratic president, had been as successful in bringing about a lot of that until the Obama administration, with support from Congress, of course. Also under Truman, just so that you have, they're worth mentioning, just so that you have a time frame to associate these with. And I'm not, we don't give Truman credit for these. It's just, there they are. So now is the moment when the Department of Defense is created. Remember, I mentioned that way back with the first cabinet. I said we've got the War Department. The first Secretary of War was John Knox, Henry Knox. And I said eventually that's going to become the Department of Defense. I mean, defense has a nicer sound to it, right, than war. And then I said it's a little bit more than just changing the name. And so we have the Department of Navy, the Department of War, and we're just going to put those together and call it the Department of Defense, which is where we're at today. But essentially, just to make this clear, the Department of Defense today is the War Department of the Washington administration. And then the 22nd Amendment comes about in 51. No more four-term presidents after Roosevelt. That's, we're not going to have that happen again. And so the 22nd Amendment, which limits the president to 2 terms or 10 years. And let's see, what do we think of there? The Populist Party, right? The Omaha Platform. One of the planks of the platform was a one-term limit for the president. Well, this is a two-term limit, but the concept is the same. Let's not give this guy or gal, it's going to happen sooner or later, an opportunity to be there forever. All right. Page 3. In 1952, Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, is elected president. Truman, a Democrat, right? I mean, if he's FDR's vice president, you figure that one out without me saying it. Here comes Eisenhower, a Republican. He will be a 2-term president, and it is fair to associate Eisenhower with the 1950s. I mean, he's president for 8 of the 10 years, right? I guess it would be 7 of the 10 years, but still, that's a fair association. So the 1950s is Dwight Eisenhower. Look at his resume. You know that he was commander of the Allied forces during World War II, considered to be an excellent president. I've seen him ranked anywhere from 9 to 15. And here's an interesting little tidbit. I haven't gotten to do many of these this year because of our time constraints to make sure that we were, where we are today with the loss of classroom time. Here's an interesting little tidbit. The only Time magazine Man of the Year twice for achievements in two professions. There's been, so Time Magazine, every year, you know this, I think, a Man of the Year, or now, you know, it's become a Person of the Year, and sometimes it's even been a, I don't know, like a Thing of the Year or something. I remember one year it was computers. Computers were the Man of the Year. All right. There's been several repeats. A person has been Man of the Year more than once, but no person for accomplishments in two professions. So Eisenhower was Man of the Year as a military commander and then as a politician. And that's, you know, there's more, that's not the end of the story, but it's a little bit like me telling you that Taft was the only person to head the executive branch and the judicial branch in history. So Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, President of the United States. And that's, at the end of the day, that's kind of a nice thing as you look back on your career. And so, same thing here. It's a nice bit of recognition for Eisenhower. It doesn't make him suddenly a George Washington, but still, it's nice recognition. Let's see. Strong in leadership qualities, crisis management, and integrity. That's kind of deja vu. And from Truman. And so the United States is fortunate as it heads into this Cold War period that it has some pretty strong presidents there to get us off on the right foot. And remember, with the Cold War, I said that the United States did get off on the right foot. Absolutely. Lots of Cold War victories for the United States initially. He will, in both elections, defeat Adlai Stevenson of Illinois. That's unusual. I mean, the same two presidential candidates in back-to-back elections, we've had that a few times, but it's been opposite results. But here, the same result. And you kind of scratch your head a little bit and think, you know, Democrats, you know, you're running the same guy against the same guy? I don't know. So anyway, same result. And the slogan that we associate with Eisenhower, the campaign slogan is, you know, I like Ike. Adlai Stevenson has a wonderful moment in history. And that's during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He is the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And you saw this in 13 Days if you watched the movie. It's an absolute pinnacle moment in history for Stevenson. He practically single-handedly backs his Russian Soviet counterpart into the corner. When the Soviets were denying that the missiles existed in Cuba, and Stevenson baits him into denying three or four times to the assembly, the UN assembly, and therefore to the world, that this is what's going on. And then after accomplishing that, I mean, it was very very precise. After doing that and having him exactly where he wanted him, then he just revealed to the world the photographs, and it was undeniable. So it was a little bit like, remember the U-2 incident where the spy plane was shot down over Russia and the United States denied it? The Soviet Union baited us and baited us and baited us, and then finally revealed the pilot who had survived, and so the United States had egg on its face. Well, so we just Stevenson managed to reverse that with the Soviet Union. So the Cuban Missile Crisis, the high point in the Cold War, the turning point, that's one of the things to remember. After two or three Cold War defeats, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a great victory for the United States. It shifted that momentum, which had been the Soviets, back to the United States. And this was Stevenson's act was part of that. Vice president under Eisenhower is Richard Nixon. And so here begins his national political career. And there's two or three episodes for Nixon. You all know that Nixon is the only president to ever resign prior to the end of the term, and that's because of all of the corruption of the Nixon administration. Well, guess what? We get a little glimpse of that right here. So even as vice president, he's accused of wrongdoing. He's accused of operating a slush fund. You know what a slush fund is? It's just sort of extra money that nobody tells anybody else about. And you're not really accountable. You don't really have to, you don't write checks on it. You don't sign it out. You have no record. It's just like, you know what? Here, we've got some money here. And so he's accused of operating a slush fund and goes on TV and denies that and does so in a fairly convincing manner. Checkers is his dog. And so he denies using this slush fund, and then he brings up right at the end, this is Nixon, that my daughter, Trish, has been given a dog. I mean, politicians aren't supposed to take gifts, right? Has been given a dog. His name is Checkers. And guess what? We like him so much, we're just going to keep him. You know, and it's meant to be sort of a humorous, somewhat humorous ending to his denial of using this slush fund. So that's his Checkers speech. TV. All right. Entire first inaugural address of Eisenhower is devoted to foreign policy. Oh, well, wow. I wonder if that makes sense, considering the situation. Most influential cabinet member, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, and his brinkmanship. So a reminder again for the 28th time, in moments of significant foreign affairs for the United States, it would be a good idea to have some of these secretaries of state in mind. His Dulles's brinkmanship, remember that political cartoon by Herblock, an extreme form of containment. Too much. All right, that's why it was called brinkmanship. And then, just like I did with Truman, there's a bunch of Cold War business for you as more review than anything else. And then notice the last half starts the turn in the Cold War from it's going all the way of the United States and then some Soviet victories there at the end of the Eisenhower administration. Domestic issues. There's some more emojis, and you can see some mixed success. The first one, initiated massive highway construction program. That's the Interstate Highway Act of 1956, and there's more about that later on. I have actually quite a bit to say about that. Largely insensitive to the emerging issue of civil rights. Don't take that too far. It's a tough political issue at this moment. All right. Okay, next page, page 4. So, also under Eisenhower, you know, I did the also under Truman. that a new department, health, education, and welfare, was created. Alaska and Hawaii are granted statehoods. And that was, just so you know, that was a an agonizing moment for a person who is borderline OCD, Alaska and Hawaii. It ends up this way because that's alphabetical order, Alaska and Hawaii. But Hawaii became a state before Alaska. Hawaii early in the year, and then Alaska, I think, in August. So I've actually got them listed as state number 50 and state number 49. So quite a agonizing position for someone who's borderline OCD. But I went with this because this is visual. You can't see the 50 and 49. All right. Eisenhower's farewell address contained warning against what he called the military-industrial complex. Know that term, associated with Eisenhower and the Cold War. I'm thinking back to the Nye Committee. Remember, it was the Nye Committee post-World War I, who will claim Senator Gerald Nye from North Dakota headed the committee, that will claim that the United States was drawn into World War I because of business elements. It's all about profit. And there's American businesses who profit if the U.S. goes to war. And, excuse me, we spent a few moments on that. And so this is essentially a warning against that sort of military-business dependency, association. All right. Because that's going to get us probably one place, knowing that business likes to make money. And then here's two Herblock political cartoons. Herblock just works his magic concerning Eisenhower. Herblock wasn't a big fan of Eisenhower. And so the first political cartoon, there's Eisenhower in the chief, the fireman's outfit, uniform. Okay. And out the window, there's a fire raging. Civil rights crisis. And then you see Eisenhower turning to, well, the United States or somebody else and saying, gee, you know, somebody should do something about that. So it's as though Eisenhower recognizes that there needs to be something done, but he's got the fire uniform on, fireman's uniform on. Yeah, you're the guy. But he just doesn't want to step up to the plate, according to Herblock. And then the next political cartoon, there's Eisenhower flying above the chaos of what's going on. You see civil rights there, but you also see a couple other issues down there. The chaos, political, I guess, chaos in the United States. Well, social too. And Eisenhower has that look on his face, just sort of, you know, out for a nice helicopter flight in the afternoon, and seems just sort of indifferent to what's going on. So the theme of both of those political cartoons is, you know, identical. It's just that in the earlier one, in 56, it was centered on one particular issue, whereas the 57 is a little bit more encompassing. The American dream was never bigger in the United States than it was in the 1950s. For a number of reasons. Let's start with television. So there's a number of qualities that you want to associate with the 50s. And I started you off with a couple right there. The 1950s was all about materialism. and homogeneousness. In other words, we're all going to bring this in. We're all going to be from the same cookie cutter. Here's my analogy. Here's my analogy. So the 1950s was all about, you've all been in the airports with the moving walkways. And so it's all about the 1950s, just getting on the walkway and getting from here to there. Just enjoy the nice ride. You're going to get there. You're going to get there, you and everybody else. Everybody in front of you, everybody in back, you're all going to get there. And as you look, as you're going on this runway, you're going to see stuff going on. Don't get distracted. There might be even some bad stuff that you want to do something about or you don't feel real comfortable about. But look, you're headed in. You're getting there. Just don't rock the boat. Just be happy that you're gliding through life, you and everybody else. And if nobody rocks the boat, then this can be a nice ride for all of us. That's what the 1950s was about. That's the homogeneousness. So, central to the culture of the 50s, the television. Its impact was rapid and profound. Look at the last item there. Remember when I introduced you to the radio, 1920s, KDKA, the first commercial radio station in America, Pittsburgh, 1920. First broadcast was about the 1920 presidential returns. So I told you that for a couple decades now, radio is going to be what TV becomes. It's sports, it's news, it's entertainment. So I'm pretty sure I did this. When families would gather around the radio to watch the radio, which of course you don't really do, right? But you kind of do because you're listening to it. And so welcome, listening audience, to the Texaco Entertainment Hour. Without further ado, let's get on with tonight's story. And so maybe it starts out with the narrator is talking about a farm and describing that. And so if I've already done this, then you know where I'm going with this. But so you all have now, there's 25 farms. You've all got your own farm in your mind. And that's the cool thing about radio. But now with TV, you don't get that choice. The TV creates your farm. So the same presentation, the same story on TV that's on radio limits your creativity. Because, like I said, you get the farm you get is whatever farm the writers come up with on TV. You all get the same farm. And if you don't like the fact that it has a smallish red house instead of a larger white house, then well, that's, you just got to live with it because that's what you're getting on TV. So the TV is a powerful tool for influencing American life and habits. You know that. And so it gives in the 1950s, the TV is on the walkway. It's going to give an idealized image of American life. And so, you know, a lot of that is, well, at the time, white, middle class, suburban. Yeah, there's issues, but, you know, as long as you stay on the moving walkway, they don't have to be your issues. They can be somebody else's issues. If you see an issue off there, an issue off, let that be their issues. Let's just stay right here. Okay, next page, 5, time check, time to